the first time that we've actually sat down and pre-recorded a program. The reason for that is because Nick Redfern, our guest, the author of Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story, he and his wife booked himself a nice vacation in a very nice beach house that has no telephone on the Mexican coast. Many months ago, the book itself was due for release in March. Simon & Schuster, in its infinite wisdom, delayed publication. Nick wouldn't get a refund on his vacation booking, and so he's leaving town. As the stuff starts to hit the fan, Redfern bails. No, I...
Got your stuff all packed?
Yeah, he's leaving the country. UFO writers don't make any money really writing about UFOs, and to book a holiday and then lose your money because a book is coming out, it's not Nick's fault. Let us get back to the meat of the matter here with Victor Vigiani and Dave Frelott. There we are. They've married this contraption, this thing that looks like a cross between the Horton flying wing and the early American flying wings that we've all seen pictures of. They've married this technology together with the new style Fugo balloons. Something happens that make the Americans decide over New Mexico that this is not going to work for them.
Well, what happened was that, as a lot of UFO proponents believe, or as is a matter of record, that on the night of when this material came down at the Brazel Ranch, the Foster Ranch, there was a large thunderstorm, that this wasn't a nighttime launch, but the storms in the summer months, they come out of nowhere without even any rain. They literally are just a thunderstorm that comes and goes.
Yeah, been down in Roswell when that's happened.
Yeah. Even as some of the UFO proponents think, the story I got was that this huge device, which was literally massive, was struck by lightning. The aircraft below the balloon system actually became partly detached with its nose pointing to the ground and ended up literally spinning out of control. And obviously the experiments already failed. The plan was simply to get the aircraft back on the ground as quickly as possible at White Sands. That obviously was completely out of the window. That had gone. The balloon and the aircraft hanging below it were just going off in the distance. And because the emergency people on the ground were presuming that this was either going to land or, in a worst-case scenario, crash land, there was never any indication that it was actually going to be carried away by the balloons. The thing about this experiment that was classified was the fact that they were using a Japanese crew in this advanced aircraft. If when the aircraft became detached from the balloons and it landed successfully, if somebody found the balloons, it wouldn't be too much of a problem because there was no way to know what they would have been used for. You see what I mean? It would have just been a large balloon system.
Yes.
In the same way with the government's explanation that it was a Mogul balloon that came down. If you found a Mogul balloon, you would never know it was anything strange. It was a normal balloon, but it was what it was being used for.
Right.
Secret. The plan was to have the people at White Sands on standby in the event of an emergency crash or crash landing. The balloon debris would be recovered at a later date.
Mm-hmm.
They never anticipated the fact that the aircraft would actually end up traveling with the balloon materials. Part of the balloon array and the aircraft became detached from the whole array, and the weight of the balloons brought the aircraft down. Everybody was killed and the aircraft was destroyed. The people I interviewed said that when the recovery was undertaken, and bear in mind again, you know, this is with these small 5-foot-tall pilots trained to fly the thing, when it was recovered, they all said that nobody outside the military actually saw the recovery of this vehicle and the crew. But when they got there, to their dismay, they found that where the lightning had struck and the aircraft had finally become detached from the balloon system, literally about a 9 to 10 foot long piece of the outer shell on the ceiling, the roof of the aircraft, had become ripped away with the remaining balloon system. And one of the crew members was missing, actually being sucked out. And they said that the huge field of strange debris that Rancho Brazel found was actually the main balloon system. And there is actually some evidence that Brazel also did find the remaining body. I've actually got testimony in the book from people who talked about Brazel saying that, quote, he came across something else in addition to the balloon debris and decomposing body parts found on the Foster Ranch. A number of people who I interviewed for the book said a lot of the UFO commentators don't really get into the issue of why there should be this vehicle at one location with bodies and why there should be this huge debris field at another location which seem to be made of distinctly different materials.
How far apart would that be, Nick?
Well, actually, we're talking quite a few miles, because in terms of aerospace, traveling 30 or 40 miles, which we are talking about, in terms of, you know, the objects becoming detached at a high height and then separating. But what actually saying is that why would there be this location with bodies and this vehicle at one site and then this huge field of debris at another? But as the one guy I interviewed, who was worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency, commented to me or observed, if you look at this as two distinctly different vehicles, if you like, or elements of one vehicle, one being an aircraft and one being a balloon, and they became detached, then the explanation as to why there should be a vehicle and bodies at one site and this huge field at another, that kind of explains it. If one was a huge balloon and one was an aircraft that was sent up together but then became separated. One of the biggest controversies about this whole issue is, why on earth did the Roswell Army Airfield say that they recovered a flying disc? That's kind of the crux of the story. And as I said to the guy from the DIA, well, you know, if you want to hide a classified experiment where you've secretly brought over Japanese pilots, you don't announce to the world that you've just recovered a flying saucer and hope to hide the story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the entire world media is going to descend upon that story. And he said that what happened was that Brazel brought in the balloon-like wreckage, and the people at Roswell began to ask questions secretly within the area. Has anybody lost a classified project because something's come down and this guy has found it? The people at White Sands initially didn't realize that part of the material evidence was missing. They thought they got it all at the aircraft and balloon location. They didn't realize that some was still missing. And so nobody told Roswell anything, that anything was missing. You know, nobody would own up to having lost anything, because they were secure in their minds, at that time at least, that they got all the materials.
They didn't discover that they were missing a crew member?
Well, this is kind of a grey area. Mm. Brazel, it seems from some of the witnesses, got out there and made his announcement before the White Sands people had fully secured the other site. And so that's why White Sands were confident, at that stage at least, they needn't say anything, because they did think they got everything, and then when they realized they hadn't, the story from Brazel was already out there. And bearing in mind, this was only like a week or so after the Kenneth Arnold sighting, you know, people have said, well, how could someone mistake a flying saucer for balloon debris? The big argument is this was only a week after the Kenneth Arnold sighting. You know, there was no UFO magazine or anything like that. And so how would anybody know that UFOs weren't made of balloon debris? There was no kind of like 50 or 60 year lore and literature to say otherwise.
The press talked about the sighting over the Cascade Mountains, Kenneth Arnold, the Roswell flying disc. Who leaked that story? And is that part of it true?
It wasn't a leaked story. The story I got was that Roswell, the base, believed that they got their hands on flying disc debris purely because nobody within the area would own up to having lost something classified. And they recognized that this was unusual. It was a huge balloon system that they didn't recognize. And it was actually polyethylene coated with aluminum, depending on
Where you come
you
from. Yeah.
kind of seen as unusual. And, you know, at that time, you know, flying disc didn't necessarily mean alien spaceship. For all people knew, a week after the Kenneth Arnold sighting, flying discs were like spy balloons launched by the Russians. Nobody knew what they were. So the story I got was that Roswell genuinely believed they got their hands on a flying disc. Nobody would own up to having lost anything. And then when they put the story out, White Sands realized that what the people at Roswell actually announced finding is part of this classified project of theirs. And so then that's when the Defense Department say, what are these people doing putting out this story? They've just compromised a major project at White Sands. And Roswell is saying, well, we asked, nobody would admit to having lost anything. We put out this story because that's what we thought it was.
When White Sands actually launched that particular aircraft for the test, how did they manage to miss when it crashed and losing part of it? Were they not observing the test or keeping that test under observation from point A to point B?
The story I got was that they anticipated literally having this thing just take off above White Sands and have the aircraft detach and land, and then where the balloons landed, they would just recover them. The story I got was that what actually happened was when the balloon got struck by lightning, or the whole system got struck by lightning, and it just carried itself off to nowhere, they didn't actually have aircraft in the air circling around looking for it, but they didn't anticipate that happening. The crews and the emergency people were on the ground. When the entire thing just basically headed off, yes, they launched aircraft, but the fact that there was no aircraft there in the air at the time meant that they were kind of like some distance or time behind it. And when they located the initial point where the aircraft and a section of the balloon system had come down from the air, they presumed that was all of it. They didn't realize that part of the balloon system, at least, had carried on somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so they just focused on that particular location, got the personnel out there to secure the site, and then realized that part of it was missing. And then they had to launch another investigation. And that's what held them up, was the fact that having found this first location and put all their effort into cleaning up that site and securing it, when actually got all the debris, which was, you know, pretty much smashed up because of a heavy landing, when they finally secured that and realized that there were things missing, then they've got to initiate another investigation and search. By the time they'd secured the first site, it was like late at night or early hours, that they couldn't then begin the next search until the following morning, and had no real idea, because it was nighttime, where the remaining materials had gone to. And by that time, Brazil had gone into town, and they were kind of one step behind the civilians and then one step behind Roswell.
This was the first balloon launched with the aluminum foil and the polypropylene covering. Is that what you said, Nick?
Yeah, there actually weren't many balloons launched into the air or before that time had this combination.
So that would account for the Jesse Marcel Jr. story of his dad showing him this incredible magic foil that when you crumpled it up sprang back into shape.
Yeah.
All of this information comes from several whistleblowers, the first of one of which contacted you because of a chapter in a previous book of yours, and that was Oak Ridge Labs, the original whistleblower worked at, and consequently she turned you on to other people who corroborated her story and added more details that you've got into this book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things actually people won't know from the book, but I'm quite happy to tell them, is that, as we've mentioned, a lot of these people are whistleblowers under pseudonyms, but in many cases, the abbreviated or altered names actually weren't done by me. This was actually done by the legal department at Simon & Schuster, who were concerned about revealing, you know, the names of intelligence personnel, and particularly like the people at the involved in the Home Office story.
Yeah.
Some of those people actually are still serving to this day. I can prove that. Mm-hmm. And they were highly concerned about revealing names. And so one thing I've had to do with this book, which I've never actually had to do ever with a book before, was have extensive meetings and interviews with the legal department, or interviews, not meetings, but interviews and phone conversations with the legal department about the fact that we had to alter some of these names. My original manuscript actually has the names of the people in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the finished book that doesn't.
Well, it's good you've clarified that, because a lot of people will say, well, no names, no pack drill, we can't follow up on it. But you, in fact, do know who those people are.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I'll be the first to admit that in many ways, you know, this story, aside from the fact that it has a down-to-earth explanation, is very similar to the thing that happened with Bill Moore, with his meetings with people, you know, when he gave names like Falcon and Condor and things like that.
The aviary.
That's right, the aviary. And in many respects, this was a very similar situation. And again, I don't get into this in the book, really, purely for space reasons more than anything else. But even the interviews themselves were kind of strange, where I'd be literally told, you know, you need to go to a particular restaurant. One of the ones that was regular was a Mexican restaurant at exit 333 on the I-35 to Waco. So it was a case of, you know, you will go to that restaurant and a guy will turn up with slick back white hair. He's an elderly guy. He's the one who's going to speak to you about this story. And that is very much the way in which the interviews were conducted, sort of cloak and dagger, out of the way, deep throat type locations and type of interviews. Mm-hmm. Now, again, as I said, I don't go into that in the book, really, purely for space reasons more than anything else.
Right.
But, you know, I think collectively, from my perspective at least, the accounts they've related to me and the build-up with the balloons and the Unit 731, I think collectively it offers the best explanation, you know, as far as, was it a UFO, was it a mogul balloon, was it a weather balloon, was it crash test dummies? You know, I think collectively out of these various scenarios, that one or this one, I should say, offers the best alternative, if you like.
Could I get a clarification from
sure.
you, Nick? Am I right in assuming that the way this thing evolved, the way it turned out, the way this thing crashed, and the way the UFO spin story stuck to this thing for nearly 60 years, am I to understand that the way that the UFO story stuck, the reasoning behind that was to cover up other clandestine things that the United States government was doing?
Yes. I mean, you know, on one hand, the idea that a Japanese crew piloting this futuristic aircraft should crash isn't in itself necessarily something that would be necessarily to be classified after 60 years. It would just be some sort of weird experiment that went wrong. And, you know, it's already admitted that America brought over the paperclip scientists from Germany, so why not just admit something similar happened with Japan? But what I got was that in addition to this experiment, far more controversial experiments were also being undertaken, such as extremely high-altitude balloon experiments in the summer of 47 in the New Mexico desert, and ejection capsule experiments using people. And actually some of these people brought over from Japan. And the fear was that if they revealed the truth about the fairly strange but not necessarily overly controversial Roswell crash, that people inevitably would uncover the truth about these far more controversial episodes. And so the entire thing was hidden under this UFO banner. And again, one of the other things I got was that, you know, some people say, well, the crash was at this location, or it was here, or there were two bodies. No, there were four bodies. No, there were five bodies. What I got was that between May and August 47, there were a range, possibly six or seven different experiments, such as this one, others being high-altitude balloon experiments, some experiments for the nuclear energy for propulsion of aircraft program, and different people had their own unique angle on some of these different incidents, all believing that what they saw was, quote, the Roswell incident, when in actual fact, a whole range of these experiments have been collectively remembered and, if you guess, I guess come together in one unholy mess that's become known as the Roswell incident.
And you, interesting that you say atomically powered aircraft, which is, that's presumably what Cash and Lundrum, the two women down there in your neck of the woods, actually ran into on a side country road one day.
Yeah.
A very loud, noisy kind of spaceshipy looking thing escorted by helicopters, and one of them eventually died, one of the women eventually died of radiation poisoning.
Yeah, I've actually seen one or two actually incorrect reviews and comments about the book where I actually say that the government was test flying a nuclear powered aircraft in the summer of 47. They weren't, you know, there was simply no nuclear powered engine.
Right.
All they were doing was kind of simulations, exposing people to radioactive materials, literally, and loading aircraft with radioactive materials and then installing prototype shielding materials to see if the crew at one end of the aircraft would be shielded by this new prototype shielding system from just outright radioactive materials, not even a, you know, a reactor or anything like that. Just really crude early stage experiments.
Now, did the whistleblowers point directly at survivors from the wartime version of Unit 731 having these experiments done on them, or were these all military, North American military personnel?
The bacteriological warfare, chemical warfare, and low and high pressure experiments, they're all undertaken by Unit 731. And one of the prime motives was to get hold of the paperwork to see what effects this had had on people.
But
there are also references to some of these, the survivors of these experiments being brought over purely to try and understand what the effects were and how the people had been affected.
Those experiments were conducted on the Japanese prisoners, on the prisoners of the Japanese on United States soil that you know of.
Yeah, well, it was kind of a combination. Some undertaken in Japan, but particularly the high altitude experiments undertaken in the States.
Using
plague experiments and virus experiments undertaken in Japan, but the Americans wanting to understand what the effects were, so bringing them those people over, the survivors, so they could be studied.
Ah, after they'd been subjected or
yes.
exposed to. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I guess that has a certain amount of value, knowing that they weren't quite as awful as the people at Unit 731.
Mm. Although some of these experiments with high-altitude balloons did sound very dubious from what the people told me, you know, literally needing to determine how a person is affected by literally launching a balloon as high as you can. And I actually found at the National Archives, based upon a tip from two of the interviewees, and this is why I suspect, you know, that they're speaking truthfully. Bear in mind, if you go to the National Archives in Maryland, that, you know, there are millions and millions of files on hundreds of thousands of different subjects. They actually pointed me in the direction of two specific files, one which talked about, in very, very vague terms, experiments on, quote, mutations at high altitudes in the summer of 47 in New Mexico. And another one, we actually talked, of all places, Oak Ridge, in which Oak Ridge was actually receiving files on experiments actually undertaken in July to August 47, radiation experiments that had been undertaken on dwarfs and people suffering from progeria, this condition which results in a person having a small body and a large, enlarged bald head.
Oh, as in the alien autopsy movie,
exactly.
Perhaps?
And what's interesting is that, you know, if somebody could go to the National Archives, not only would you not know if those files existed, even if they existed, where would you begin to look for them?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they, you know, they directed me to the file name, the author of the file, I literally found it within one day.
Wow.
And, you know, to actually find officially released files, not leaked MJ-12 type files, but official files talking about radiation experiments undertaken on people who had an adult height of 5 feet and an enlarged bald head in the summer of 47.
Victor and I and Dave and I have all been discussing the possible ramifications on the UFO field and the mainstream media. Nick Redfern, what do you see in all of this?
I know we're all guilty of having belief systems, but my motivation has always been to try and get to the heart of the mystery of what lies behind the UFO subject or aspects of the UFO subject and uncover those truths wherever they lead. And I think the only responsible thing to do, whether it's Roswell or whatever case, is just to try and do so in an unbiased fashion and just examine the evidence and see where it leads and not be kind of tied too much to preconceived belief systems. And certainly not my motivation to say, you know, how I got there before you sort of thing and I solved it. That's not what I want to do. What I'm trying to do is say to people, look, it may well be the case that on some of these more controversial cases, we've actually been deceived for years, and now maybe we can actually start deconstructing this cover story or these cover stories that have been put in place using a UFO cover to hide far more dubious things, such as the Paul Benowitz case of 1980, in which the Air Force just disinformed him to the point where he had a nervous breakdown about bogus UFO stories. And so I think what I'm hoping is that people won't kind of see me as a debunker, because I'm certainly not. You know, arguably, I'm coming up with a story that's even more controversial.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping is people won't see me as a debunker. They'll see me as someone who's actually trying to penetrate this layer of disinformation that's actively being promoted by the military or the intelligence services for far more dubious reasons. And so I feel that, you know, this isn't the end of Roswell or the end of UFOs. It's actually the beginning of trying to find an answer to this one particular aspect of the subject, you know.
And it really is the only logical, I mean, and not to say that UFOs are illogical, but it's the only comes together really nicely and tidily solution to something that's been bothering UFO researchers for the last 30, 40 years.
You know, I think that the biggest thing about the Roswell case that let down the alien path was the fact that I think no one could recognize what else these bodies could be. They obviously weren't 6 foot US military pilots. They looked unusual. What else could they be if they weren't alien? When you find out there are official files talking about experiments on dwarfs in 47, that you actually find references to small trained Japanese pilots flying in futuristic balloons, when you put those two aspects together, then it kind of gives another representation on what these bodies could have been. And for me, that was one of the things that led it away from the alien path, and also the absurd idea that these were 6 foot tall crash test dummies that had the legs broken off, so they looked only 5 foot tall, which is what the Air Force would have us believe. So it won't certainly lay the entire matter to rest. It'll actually now galvanize people to dig further, because one of the interesting things is that aspects of this story have been floating around for years. In 1997, Popular Mechanics magazine came out with practically an identical theory that this would be seen as a next generation Fugo balloon with like a Horton device, and that the pilots were Japanese personnel Borova. They actually wrote that in 97 and said they'd been alerted to a forthcoming release of documents. So the other people out there know about angles of this story.
Those documents don't exist anymore, any of them. This is all from whistleblower memory, right? Other than the specific document or two that you found.
Yeah.
The great majority of all the paperwork on these projects is gone.
This is a problem. I mean, obviously, if a UFO had crashed, then there's no way that would be destroyed. The bodies and the aircraft or the vehicle would be stored away for analysis.
Yeah.
But as the interviewee said to me, if, as they believe, all we had was like balloon debris and a glider and Japanese pilots, there'd be no need to keep all that when the analysis had been completed and when the projects were disbanded. It would just be destroyed. And to cover their tracks, the people involved destroyed the files to hide the paper trail that would lead back to Unit 731. And so, as one of the people I interviewed said to me, it may well be the case that all we've got left now are old men with old memories. That was his literal words. Stuart Miller of UFO Review interviewed me and said, is it possible then that the US government today may not have a complete picture itself of what actually occurred at Roswell? And I think that's an interesting and intriguing scenario, that maybe the government itself actually doesn't know what happened. Today's government, I mean, there are certainly, you know, retired old people out there who know it and are going to take the secrets to the grave with them. At an official level, there may not actually be something in an archive.
That's one of the things that is really puzzling me. And in addition to that, this is all clearly historical information that you're bringing out here, some 50 or 60 years old. How long do you suspect this information has been out there, Nick, and floating around in the intelligence circles? And why has it come to such a critical mass point right now?
Well, why, for me at least, it's come to a critical mass is because purely I spoke to this lady out in California about Oak Ridge, and it's like I said to Stuart, somebody said, can you be a little bit pregnant? No, you can't. And it's like, with this, was she able to tell me a little bit of the story and have it go no further? No, she couldn't. She kind of blew the whistle, and then based on what she said, I actually tracked some of these people down, and then it was like the train going down the track. So that's why it's reached a critical mass from my perspective. But as far as the story being out there, I mean, John Keel, as far back as 1990, expressed the possibility this was a Fugo balloon. Popular Mechanics expressed this. I've actually been going through some of Leonard Stringfield's old reports, and in his 1991 status report, which is the thickest report he ever wrote, about 140 pages, he actually talks at the very end about how he'd been told by some of his insider sources that the Roswell legend was actually based around a U.S. experiment connected with biological warfare, which sounds, again, very, very similar to this. So aspects are out there.
Aspects of it have been out for a while, and the aspect is that we have run out of time, gentlemen. None of us got all the questions in we wanted to ask you. I guess what we have to do is either send you email via the UFO updates list, and let's have that discussion online at UFO updates, as I'm sure it will be.
You think that'll happen?
Oh. And listening to this play back on air on Saturday night, I'm going to know exactly how it played out. Nick Redfern, thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks, Errol. Thanks, guys.
Body Snatchers in the Desert is the book, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story, put out by Paraview Pocket Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and is available right now as we speak. Dave Frelott, thank you.
Thank you.
See you next week, Dave.
For sure.
Victor Vigiani, thank you, sir.
It's been a pleasure.
This is not going to go away, is it?
Not a chance.
Eyes to the bookshelves and secondarily to the skies. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp.